We use smartphones every day. We get anxious when we forget them, and we have a very personal relationship with it, but we have no idea how it's made. Most of the harm is already done when you have your phone in your hands. 70 to 80% of that phone footprint is in the making of it, not in the usage of it. Only 15% of the phones that you put away get recycled eventually. Our ambition from the start was not to create a phone company and really go into a full-blown competition of the big phone guys. We decided to do a crowdfunding. All of a sudden, we had a list of over 30,000 people that said that they were interested in actually buying a phone if we really made it happen. To be able to have enough cash to produce the phones that we could promise to the people that ordered one, we needed like a couple of million to actually close a growth gap in a couple of weeks, because I was just seeing that the shit was hitting the fan. I started sending emails to Richard Branson and whoever, trying to find money. In the end, we succeeded to raise 5 million within a couple of weeks. But I can tell you that was the most stressful situation ever in my life in terms of the pressure. My partner at the time, she brought me to the mental health clinic, the crisis center, because I was having panic attacks already for days and weeks. I just couldn't do it anymore.
Bonjour, bonjour, and welcome to Mission First, the podcast to learn from successful entrepreneurs changing the world for the better. In this podcast, you will learn from entrepreneurs who have already found product market fit and are scaling up fast. We discuss their challenges and the strategies they have applied to make things work. Think of it as a masterclass about business and product innovation, growth marketing, and leadership. I am Gilles Toussaint. I help mission-driven companies exceed their revenue objectives with growth marketing, product-led growth, and LinkedIn personal branding strategies. How many people can say they are building a company that competes directly with Apple, Samsung, and other phone companies? How many have been able to do so while at the same time offering a product which is both circular and fair? Today, I'm very excited to talk to Bas van Abel. He's the founder of Fairphone, a company that has now sold more than 500,000 phones across the globe, making them fair and repairable. Today, we are going to talk about three insightful topics for any entrepreneur out there: how to operate a circular model and how to make it fair, how to balance social ambition with business side, how to take care of your personal health. Bas, welcome to Mission First. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, the sun is coming up, so it's an exceptional occasion in Holland, especially this time of year, so I'm happy.
Yeah, it's better than here in Berlin, which is pretty gray today. Welcome to Mission First. So can you start by telling us, what's your mission, and is it different than the mission of Fairphone?
My mission has always been based on my fascination from where stuff comes from. I'm a designer, I'm an engineer. I look around me, I see all these products, all this stuff made, and I really wonder, where does it come from? Who made it? Where does it end up if you don't use it anymore? And these are questions I see that are less and less asked. And with the work I've been doing in the last, I think, 20 years, one of my driver has always been opening up products. I've written a book also on open design and how to surface also better what's happening behind the scenes. Because in the end, it's, our economic system is a magical system that we are able to make stuff and democratize consumption in a way. We have more products to use at our vicinity than the Queen of England in the 1900s. So it's great that we have all that stuff. But for me, where does it come from, and how do we make it? And just trying to find out how we can make sure that we don't toss it away that easily. And a lot of that is, I think, you see back in all the projects which I've done, and amongst them, the biggest one until now for sure has been Fairphone. But one of the things I've learned through developing a lot on open design and open hardware is that when you have people work together on making products, you see that their connection towards those products really change. And having worked within the social cultural context with technology, I also saw the distance that we as people have created between us and the devices that we use, and especially technology, which became kind of a black box. It's like a mythical device, a black box, what we don't know what's happening behind the scenes. And I'd like to bring back people to the origin of that. And I've seen that with open source software development, open hardware really changed also the responsibility people take towards the use of the products once they become part of the development of it.
And so you started Fairphone. How long has Fairphone been there?
Fairphone has been there since 2011 when we started as a campaign. And at that time I was working at the Media Lab as a creative director, and I was already involved in, like I said, in technology and at the open hardware side of it. I was also one of those designers where, you know, I know at the time we were sending files to China and we got a whole container of stuff back, right? And I always wonder what's happening behind the scenes in these factories. And then a friend of mine came to me and he asked me to help with a campaign around conflict minerals. And I didn't know at the time about conflict minerals, but he asked me to, he told me that conflict minerals are minerals being mined in areas like Congo, the Great Lake region. And a lot of conflict is related to mining of these minerals, and these minerals are being used in electronic devices. So a lot of the technology we use has these minerals in there. I'm not even talking about the working conditions, but even have conflict related to the origin of it. And he said, Bas, you're involved in technology that much, and you've always looked at how, you know, how, in a more critical way towards technology. You know, maybe we can come up with a campaign together to raise awareness around, yeah, the conflict minerals. And for me, that was a really nice challenge because, like I said, I've been diving as deep into technology as the factories in China at that point, and wondering how things are made and also the machines and digital fabrication and stuff like that. But I never went that deep into making products, you know, all the way up into the ground. And it fascinated me because it also shows how our economic system is capable of making very, very, very complex products by working together without even knowing we're working together, like smartphones, like computers, like all these things. And that we, as you know, as people working on that, are able to make something as complex as a phone by just taking stuff from the ground and working together. And I think that kind of paradox of not knowing that magical kind of economic system, or not relating to that magical economic system in a way and alienating from the products that we've used, but on the other hand, also being able to make such complex products all the way in the, you know, from the mines, made me that I said, well, let's come up with a campaign. But one of the hardest things that we bumped into is like, okay, but how do you make people aware of conflicts happening in Africa, far, far away, related to something as, you know, as complex as a phone with very complex supply chains? And I kind of liked the paradox as well. Like I said, you know, we use smartphones every day. We are connected to it. We get anxious when we forget them and we leave them home. And we have a very, very personal relationship with it, but we have no idea what happened behind the scenes and how it's made. And I think that kind of paradox made it also nice for us to take a smartphone as kind of the carrier of that story of what's happening behind the scenes all the way up to the mines. And we took a very naive kind of step and said, you know what, why don't we make a phone from scratch? You know, it all starts from the mines, we know that. And we take it, you know, we start in the mines and we take it from there. We set up a company called Fairphone and we go step by step. We go through that whole supply chain, making that phone, raising basically the awareness around what, you know, how a phone is made, looking through the eyes of a phone, to the world and to everything that's happening. And then maybe doing that, we can find out what we can do to improve things. And at the same time, we are raising awareness and we're having that campaign that we were aiming for.
So initially, you started with this campaign with the idea of raising awareness, but not really directly in your mind, we're going to build a phone company.
I've always looked at it as a kind of as a platform, an open source phone development platform. We basically said we're going to start a phone company and everyone can help make that phone, and we call it Fairphone. So what we wanted to create was a platform in which people, companies, everybody involved into making phones would be able to contribute, but also learn from how we would be able to do things differently. And actually, you know, I said we started in 2011 after campaigning for 2 years and raising awareness around these supply chains. The funny thing happened is that more and more people started asking us, you know, when is that phone coming to the market? right? So our ambition from the start was not to create a phone company and really go into a full-blown competition of the big, you know, the big phone guys. But at a certain point, we were more and more asked the question, is this phone really going to be there? And we, you know, we were running out of cash as well for the campaigning. We were looking at, you know, how do we sustain the campaign? Because we also saw that it was successful, because more and more people were, you know, getting aware of what we were doing. And we were noticed by CNN, you know, these crazy guys that are going to the mines in Congo and trying to make a phone from scratch. Because, you know, we went there and we filmed in the mines. We showed through that campaign what was happening. And more people actually thought that we were these crazy, yeah, group of people were actually going to make that phone. And that's in 2013, we decided to do a crowdfunding, because we thought, well, let's unite these things. We want to continue the campaign, so we need to have a sustainable business model to do that. And on the other hand, we saw that there was a demand for this product, where everybody in 2011 said, well, nobody gives a shit about sustainability in the phone business, and you're crazy, and nobody, you know, you can't compete with these big guys. All of a sudden, within 2 years, we had a list of over 30,000 people that said that they were interested in actually buying a phone if we really made it happen.
Did you already have a price at that time, or were you just selling people, like, you know, just signing up for the waiting list?
Yeah, we signed up for a waiting list. So we just opened a website with, and I think we just opened a MailChimp kind of a newsletter, and we said, people, well, you know, just subscribe here. And we went to Congo, showed what was happening there. I think that awareness campaign also made people more and more aware, like, we want to do something about this, because that was also the difficulty about the campaign. If you do a campaign, you always need either a bad guy or a solution, right? Because otherwise, we didn't have a bad guy. We couldn't just say, well, Apple or Nokia is the one that, you know, that is causing a war in Congo. It's not that simple. And we didn't have the solution as well, because, you know, the phone didn't exist yet, and we didn't have our own phone, so we couldn't point people towards, you know, doing something else. And I didn't want to end up just making a petition, like, and go somewhere, and then everything bleeds to that. But the biggest problem basically was that we also didn't understand the actual problem. I think what we were able to do in those 2 years running up to actually setting up a company and starting a phone company and becoming a for-profit social business was also finding out, I think, you know, in retrospect, the product market fit through kind of campaigning. And that was very interesting, because more and more people, we just found out that people were interested in that phone. And yeah, it was basically a website. People say when you go crowdfunding, you go to a crowdfunding platform. But we didn't have a crowdfunding platform. We didn't have anything. We just had our own website. We had 30,000 people on the waiting list. And we did research on how we could make that first phone, what kind of impact we could do in the supply chain. We knew that it was not going to be like the 100% perfect fair phone from the start, but it would be step by step. But we could make some difference already, we found out in that 2 years. And yeah, we just put a button on the website and said, if you buy this phone now at 325 euros, it will probably be there within 6-7 months. Okay. And the crazy thing is that within 2 months, we had 7.5 million euros on our bank account, and we had no idea what we were doing.
What was the problem there? When you said we didn't realize what was the problem there at the time?
Well, a phone is not a banana, right? It's a very, very complex product. Just to give you an idea, there's 1,200, or not 1,200, I mean, that's one of the specific phones, but there's over 1,000 components that is on the bill of material on the, you know, on the factory that puts together the Fairphone, I can tell you. And all these 1,000 components are made by hundreds and hundreds of factories. And all these factories have also hundreds and hundreds of factories that are suppliers to these factories. So you're talking about really thousands of factories involved into making a phone. And then on top of that, you're talking about refineries, the minerals. So the whole mineral supply chain is, you know, you're talking about more than 60 plus minerals that go into a phone. There's no way that you are going to connect everything with everything by just making that whole supply chain fully transparent. Because by the time you do that, the whole supply chain has changed already, because it's also a fast-paced supply chain. So when I say we didn't really understand the problem, is that it's twofold. On the one hand, we still had to find out the complexity of a phone and how to approach that in terms of making it more fair. We had to define areas how to make it more fair, and we had to also define those, you know, those, and that's the, you know, that's the complexity of the product itself. We also had to know what are the focus areas in which we want to improve also. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the impact. If you're not careful enough with, you know, with such a big product, which involves basically the whole world, in defining where you want to make a difference, and that's what I mean, we had to define our problem, is that you're basically, you're creating world peace. And creating world peace is a bit of a too big of a challenge, and it's not really... Yeah, I don't think that people would actually join if I'd say, you know, let's just go and create world peace through a phone. It's like, but who's this and why? So what we did is, when I say the problem, is we defined it in certain areas. We defined a problem area in mining, which was the original campaign where we started. So mining was really, you know, you have conflicts related to mining. Millions of people have died in the last 20 years in conflicts related to the mining of minerals we use in our phones. And not only phones, like all electronics. And if you look at the whole energy transition, a huge problem is, for example, cobalt. Cobalt is used for batteries. Our electric cars use batteries. You know, a lot of the energy we need to store, they use batteries. So there's a huge demand on cobalt. In Congo, where most of the cobalt supplies are, there's still, you know, more than 250,000 people working without good protection, without making a good living, you know, really bad working conditions. Amongst them are tens of thousands of children also still working in these mines. And then you have on top of that the conflicts with people, you know, and this is not just Congo. You have that on gold, you have that on tin, you have that on copper, you know, all these mines around the world. They, you know, people work in horrible conditions, especially in small scale and artisanal mining. So that's a huge area where we focus on in terms of the mining. But we also know, and that's what we call fair materials, we also know, and this was from the start already, that it's not, you know, you have to look at these things in a holistic way. Because we can say, you know, we're going to improve all the working conditions in mines, go pay a better wage in the mines and stuff like that. But we also know mining is bad for the environment. So you want to use as much recycled materials as well, which they call mining is virgin materials. And then you have urban mining is basically getting the stuff from products that have passed their use life. So we've developed programs also. Starting Fairphone, we already said we need to do both. We need to focus on virgin mining on Congo, on the ground, make sure that we don't have conflict minerals and have good traceability in the supply chain, but also that we focus on getting recycled resources, like electronic waste, get it back from Ghana. We have programs in Ghana even where we can get, from the start, when we started Fairphone already, that with every phone we sell, we take a phone back as well for its minerals. But that's just one area and one problem or multiple problems. And, you know, just to quickly go through it, you have problems on the working conditions in the factories. It's totally different problems. You have to, you know, you're talking about unions or working hours, overtime, bad pays. It's different dynamics than in the mines. You have the design of the phone, which is very problematic because phones are designed in a way that we can't even change batteries and we use them longer. So we had to do something there. And like I said, there's a whole area around recycling and reuse of materials and make sure that we use products and minerals that we don't have to take from the ground.
If this podcast helps you, please do me a huge favor and click on the follow button on your podcast platform. It helps to grow this podcast faster and to convince the most impactful entrepreneurs of the world to join me in these interviews so that you and other entrepreneurs can learn from them. Can you share in terms of how big the company, the team is? Do you have some like a revenue KPI you can share and like unit economics you can share to show how big right now Fairphone has became?
Yeah, sure. So we started in 2013 as a company. It was really funny because within 1.5 years, we sold over 60,000 phones. We had 16 million turnover and we were the fastest growing technology startup of Europe. So we went really fast, right? It was like Fairphone was an explosion. And I always say we were flying and we're still building the plane and I didn't know how to fly. And that's how we were managing. So that also meant that, you know, once we were going and we're a group of people that weren't necessarily phone fanatics, But we had to, you know, had to get that also done. So just fast forwarding from that moment, we are now near to like a 40 million turnover. We are over 100 people, around 150 people, located partly in Asia. We sold over 500,000 phones, and we are at our fifth Fairphone. And I can truly say that from Fairphone 1 up till Fairphone 5, we really got the hang of it. And I can truly say that we know how to make phones by now. And that also was a big learning curve. But yeah, I think we're really in business. We're a profitable company. And we actually show through this over 10 years of our existence that we've proven that there is a market for ethical electronics, for ethical smartphones, for sustainable smartphones. And we've proven that it's possible as a company to survive in such a challenging market with only, you know, big players and big buck, to survive as a small company and grow also steadily towards, you know, a very stable, healthy company.
Let's talk about what makes Fairphone actually fair and how it's circular. We discussed a bit the different parameters or really criteria you have an impact on. And the first one is the amount of time people use their phone, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's actually very simple. What happens now is people use their phone 2 to 3 years average, and that's a real shame because it can be much longer if you look at the technology, the software, everything. Most of the people can use their phone for 5 years, but you know how it is. You know, after 2 3 years, your battery goes down. You can't replace the battery because it's glued to the inside. It's like we suffer from phone anorexia in a way because we make them thinner and thinner, and therefore all this technology needs to be scrammed inside. It's super expensive to change the battery. Your screen might be cracked by that time, and your operator comes with a new subscription. And you think, well, what the heck? I'll put the phone into the drawer with the rest of the phones. And yeah, after 2 3 years, the phone is gone. Only 15% of the phones that you put away get recycled eventually. I think everybody knows that kind of scenario. I have a different version of it. But in the end, it's an extremely simple calculation, because if you can use your phone twice as long, you only need to produce half the amount of phone, and you have half the amount of electronic waste. And the great thing about that is that's where the real impact is, because most of the harm is already done when you have your phone in your hands. And I'm saying that as, like, if you just look at the amount of, you know, and I just told you about the complexity of a phone and how many components, and, you know, it's basically the whole world involved into making that product. We've put all that effort, water, land depletion, energy into making that phone. 70 to 80% of that phone footprint is in the making of it, not in the usage of it. So if you use that phone twice as long, and we already did a life cycle assessment, which is, you know, calculating what the impact is, even with the repairs included and the components, is that you reduce that footprint with significantly, with more than 30% if you use your phone twice as long. So it does make sense to focus on longevity. And what have we been doing all that time? And that is a business problem. And that's why I see a lot of the things that we are focusing on, I think, as, you know, it really as a systemic problem. And that is, our economic system is aimed at growth. Companies that make products, growth is selling more products. Selling more products means using more resources. Using more resources means ruining the world. So it's how do you stop companies also in terms of the business models from having to make money from selling more and more products? So you have several problems there already. I can tell you. So just on the phone and the technology, it's great what we have been able to do. And we are the first ones that actually have been able to make a modular phone easily repairable for customers. You just order a part online. You can replace the battery yourself. And when your screen breaks, you can just unscrew it with a screwdriver and pop in a new screen, and off you go. We give 5 years warranty on the phone. We give eight years plus updates on the software for the newest Fairphone 5. So we have been able to crack how to support that phone and how to design it in a way that people can use it longer. But the problem is that the whole industry still works on clockwork. You know, like every year, new components, and we need to make money with new technology. Well, you can put another camera in the phone. You can put another whatever, you know, even a better screen or a better processor, but your WhatsApp is not going to go faster with it. And I think we've reached that point already. But in the minds, and that is the marketing machine of the industry, there is still, they're planting a seed in your mind that you need to have that shiny phone after 2-3 years. And that is, I think, where another challenge lies for us, but also I think for everyone in terms of social enterprises, is how do we change our business models in a way that we support also that mission of longevity. These things are really connected, how you run your business and how you design your products for longer use.
Before we talk about the business model, can you explain a bit what you do differently in terms of the mining part and the fair wage in the industry at the moment?
Yeah, sure. I've told you a bit about the, you know, the design of the phone. I think it's good to know that we do not just focus on making the phone in such a way that you can use it as long as possible, but we also look at how the materials are being sourced, right? So that is the mining part, but also, for example, we use 100% recycled plastics for the casing, you know, the back covers and everything. And we are the first ones to use fair trade gold and silver credits in the supply chain. So what we try to do...
Can you explain what this actually means? Is it a reference to, like, similar to the cradle to cradle, like, batches?
No.
Of, like, how...
No, it's different. So we're the first ones to actually implement these things in electronics, right? So you have to remember that even fair trade on I think on bananas took like 7 years before they had fully implemented all these things. So what we're working on is fair mining. We work together. We do know that ourselves. We work together with Solidaridad, with other companies, with local NGOs to set up programs around fair trade mining. That's around gold, around silver. The supply chain for electronics is so complex that it's impossible to say, like with coffee, like bean to bar, where you say, well, this specific gold is going to be in this specific phone, right? So that you have a direct relation with where something is mined and that it actually ends up in your phone. What we use is mass balance systems for certain materials where you say, this is this much fair trade gold and fair trade silver that we buy on the market, and that it actually ends up in a factory that makes products for other phone companies and other brands as well. We don't know where it actually ends up. So that's what mass balances means. It goes, you know, the amount that we pay goes into the bigger system, and what goes out is used inside the electronics industry. But the great thing about setting up these kind of programs is that we are able to also get other parties on board to scale them. If you ask what is it that we do, for example, on cobalt mining, we have invested largely in cobalt mining in terms of small-scale artisanal mining, but also some of the industrial areas.
Small-scale?
Yeah, so that is people basically having a shovel and going into the mine, digging a hole in the ground and going into unprotected. So what we've done is we've put it on the radar already in 2011 as one of the critical minerals, right? And more you see in the industry that since then, they've been pushed to be more and more transparent about where companies get their stuff from. We've been really challenging Tesla, Apple, all these big guys, Google also, like, guys, listen, you can focus on recycling and have a great story there and, you know, how you reuse stuff and this and that. But you are like the big users of mining from virgin mining, from the mines in Congo. So what are we going to do about that? And one of the great things is that we were able to set up the Fair Cobalt Alliance, and we were able to get Tesla, Google, Philips, you know, all these big guys also on board. We have a spin-off company. It's an NGO that is separate now from Fairphone, the impact facility that takes care of making, of improving the mining situation around cobalt as well. So we have these silver credits, you have the gold credits, we have the artisanal, the focus on cobalt. But like I said, we use 100% recycled plastics. For that, you need to really work on a technical level with the producers on how to use that, because it's quite difficult to implement 100% recycled plastics for the detailed and small snap systems that you have in the phone, I can tell you. And we work on innovating there, and that's more on a technological level. We use recycled copper, so that's more on the supply chain. And so I can go on and on, but we have more than 12 focus minerals, and those are the minerals that we offer 60 plus that we identified as the most problematic, and on all of them we have programs running to implement them in the firm.
What was the hardest part when it comes to the supply chain, you know, as a founder building such a company or as a company? The underlying question being, what would be your advice for someone who starts a tech company right now who wants to make the supply chain as fair as possible?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's, you know, there's several approaches to that. And I think the one that we took is use your product to implement things, right? So you have a supply chain, you share that supply chain with 90% of your competitors, and by building that product, also use that as a platform to get other parties on board to join these kind of initiatives. So just look at your supply chain, look what's going on, and make that extra mile. So we've been set up to be a pioneer in that, right? So our mission is to like I said, we started Fairform really looking at it as a platform. In some way, I still see it as a safe space for also bigger companies and other companies that have huge PR risks when they work on mining and conflict mining and these things, to join these programs also, yeah, through what we're doing. And we have kind of a broker position between the NGO world and the for-profit world. You have to ask yourself, what is my mission? I think it's really important also to know, am I able to get that across to the customers? Because in the end, you will have to also be transparent about what you do and also what you can't do. And yeah, and I think at the moment it's really, really, if you want it, you can do it. And that means that there are enough initiatives that you can join. And like I said, Fairtrade Gold, Fairtrade Silver. If you add the extra cost to it, on the one hand, it's additional cost. On the other hand, for example, we are the only ones in the industry now that pays a living wage instead of a minimum wage in the factory. And it's just like, you know, it's a couple of dollars more per phone. So it's not huge differences, but in the end, a couple of dollars for big industry, you know, it's a lot of money. So you also have to be able to leverage that with your brand. And I think that is important I think it's an important thing I've learned, that you always have to look at how the work that you've been set up, you know, your mission, the impact that you want to create, how you can combine that also with your business model in a way that it also, you know, people still need to be willing to pay for that. So you also need to find out how do I make people understand that they also contribute to improving situations, or, you know, in terms of longevity, in our case, with, you know, having the phone longer, for example, that it costs them less money when they buy the product because they can use it longer. I'd be the last one to say there's always a win-win, because there's not. It's full of dilemmas. And, you know, supply chain is messy. It's very messy. And we always think, you know, you just take some textbook and, like you said, you know, where do you start? You know, auditors are always very happy to tell you how to do it, but that's just on, you know, on a textbook. But if you really go into supply chain, it's extremely messy, and you will have to find out yourself with your feet on the ground what is best for your product to improve things. It boils down to motivation, definitely.
Hey, before you jump to the next part of this episode, one quick info. If you don't want to miss the best strategies for entrepreneurs like you, sign up for my newsletter with a link in the description. You will receive a summary of advice from each episode, get personal recommendations based on your startup stage and industry. And you will also receive my most useful growth and LinkedIn marketing strategies. Just follow the link in the description to sign up. Back to the next part of this interview.
And you mentioned something that makes a perfect transition to what we wanted to talk after, which is, how do you balance your social ambition, your mission to, you know, improve the world with the business side of it? You mentioned the theory of change. So can you explain me a bit, like, what would be your advice for young founders here?
Yeah, so we work with a very clear theory of change. And theory of change means that we have a bigger kind of method on how to change that big industry, because it's a huge, fuzzy kind of, how do you call that, hairy, or big goal that you have is like to change the whole electronics industry is kind of big, right? So how do you get there? And we set up our theory of change is first we started as a campaign and campaigning company even, and we raise awareness. So really show what is going on. And by showing what is going on, you can create agitation, you can create people to act, you can do all kinds of things. But if you don't offer a solution, then you know that dies. So what we do as a second step is we innovate. You know, we innovate always on what we campaign for and what we show. We always show, you know, we always work on solutions as well, so that people can actually, you know, see these innovations, like, for example, the modular phone, longevity, a very important part. If people want to use their phone longer and want to have a replaceable battery, finally, yes, you know, let's buy that Fairphone because, you know, they have a replaceable battery. So we show actually it is done. And then the third step is that we want to convince the whole industry to join us. And convincing happens in different ways. We can inspire them, or we can do that through legislation and also lobbying. And in the case of repairable phones, we've lobbied a lot. And I know in 2012, I think I sent already a letter to the EU where I said, you know, please put phones under the EU legislation of the Eco-Design Directive. And the Eco-Design Directive is a directive that makes companies responsible for, you know, spare parts and all kinds of things when they put electronic equipment on the market. And phones were not part of it. And I asked them to do that. They answered me, yeah, we'll consider it. And to my surprise, last year, you know, I read that the EU pushed
11
through.
11 years later.
Yeah, 11 years later, the EU is going to force all phone companies, smartphone companies, to have replaceable batteries within a couple of years. And, you know, that is a big kind of, if you just focus on that, you'll be like lobbying the rest of your life, and you can set up a lobby party. But for us, it was, you know, it was clear, it was a long-term strategy that we knew we want to be in a market where what we think, you know, how things should be designed is going to be the next normal. And to get there, you also need sometimes legislation, yeah, or different business models or these kinds of things. It sounds very big, and I don't think it is in the end. If we just look back, you know, I think most people that want to set up a company, they are agitated, or they don't know. It's like something stupid happens in the system, right? Most companies are set up because something stupid happens. And you want to move towards that new reality, but you're working in the old reality. So how do I get from the old reality to the new reality? And, you know, you just make that into a theory of change. And then based on that, you define very clearly what are the impact goals that I want to reach to get there.
And you mentioned you have to have a very clear business plan with both the business and the impact deliverables. And impact shouldn't come first and business second. Can you give us a few advice about this, how you applied that to Fairphone? Because I guess at the beginning, it's also something, I mean, a lot of founders here want to put impact first, but I realize the more I talk with successful founders and companies, the most impactful ones are usually those who manage to have business really, like, also very, very much upfront in the model.
Yeah, so I've seen both, right? Where there's business, and then, you know, the whole impact becomes a greenwashing. And I've seen companies fail because of the ambition on impact and not, yeah, having almost a dedain towards making money. And the last one I've seen happening, not necessarily in Fairphone, but in other companies, where you see that, you know, you start with a lot, you know, with very activist kind of group of people want to change things, especially with Fairphone. I mean, with Fairphone, it definitely changed also in terms of culture, right? We're a very activist group. We wanted to create that change. I've never worked in the commercial sector before I started Fairphone. I didn't know business as well, right? I wasn't aware of all the financial elements to it, and I had to learn that along the way. But what I learned along the way is how important the business, running a business in the current system and making it survive in the current system, is to be able to get to where you want. And I think one of the things that a lot of people forget when they start up, you know, start their social impact company, is that you, as an entrepreneur, have to have a certain affinity with also running a business and doing business and the financial elements of it and the commercial elements. I think you know, when you start a commercial company, I think it's important to also have a commercial mind and to like certain elements that a commercial company needs. And one of those is to also be on top of the financial plan, which is, you know, which is basically the plan that the translation of your plan for the coming years. And for me, that was a bit of a struggle to find out. I was one of those people that was probably, you know, say like money is not so important. We're in it for the, you know, for the impact. And I've learned along the way that, yeah, that if you want to make impact, and it sounds very cheesy, but if you want to make impact, your business has to be solid as well. And if you go too fast on the impact that you create, if you don't have a solid commercial base or, you know, a financial healthy company, then everything becomes short term, and the only thing you'll be doing is focusing on fundraising and keeping the company alive, and it gets harder and harder to grow the company.
Have you done any mistakes in this area? And, you know, what would you do differently now if you would start?
Well, one of the things that is connected to my health, which we will talk about later, is definitely that I found it very hard to have been the sole director of the company, like the only board member from, in the first, 6-7 years of the company. That's a responsibility thing. So I would definitely, create a team of co-founders where you have good diversity also in terms of, what I said, the business and the impact minds, the creative minds.
So you were the sole founder of Fairphone?
Well, you're never the sole founder in that sense, that you're always with a team. And I mean, I've been the only one that has been there from the start, right? So it changed when we were a campaign, was a different team than when we were a company. So I've been basically the carrier of the whole journey from beginning to where we are now. And well, to where we are now, I'd say, you know, I'm not the one anymore. There's other people doing it now, but up to a very, you know, to a point that we were almost 100 people and around 15 and 20 million turnover. It was really hard to be able, you know, to be the only board member, especially when you have you're also dealing with shareholders and shareholders that become very active in the company. I've also learned that it's good to have a kind of a healthy distance between shareholders and the board.
You know, how do you do that? I'm reading, I haven't finished it, but I'm reading the book from one of the founders or CEO or from Unilever, which is what, Net Positive?
Yeah, Paul Pinn.
Who also explains that, you know, like you shouldn't have quarterly report, for example, for shareholders. So what are your tips on how to keep shareholders at a healthy distance? Because usually if they put money in it, they like to be close.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying, I mean, our shareholders are not like purely, it's not that the healthy distance for us was needed in terms of the financial push, right? So the quarterly push and stuff like that, we have impact-driven shareholders, and even the main shareholder of Fairphone in the beginning, because you know we didn't have investors, we just had the founding organizations like a Back Society, from which Fairphone came, was also the one that brought in the first financial means to be able to do the crowdfunding. But we raised over 20 million of worth of crowdfunding before we even, and we were already like
from private people.
No. It was just pre-sales, just selling phones 6 months before you ship them, right? So that is it's basically pre-financing the company and everything, which was also not a very good idea if I look backward, because we've been too late to actually build our own capital, especially when you have a capital-intensive business. But that's another thing I can tell you about what I've learned. But the I think a healthy relationship with your shareholders happens when I was in a situation where I was not I didn't have the majority of the shares, but I was taking all the responsibility. Then you need to have, you know, and that is not uncommon in a later stage in the company, but in this early stage, it was a bit of a thing. And then the major shareholder was very involved on the other hand, which was also great in the beginning, but at a certain point, it became like, you know, who's basically steering the company here? So with a healthy relationship, I mean how much shareholders have to say, not necessarily because they are too financially driven, but in general, because as a founder, you have to have, and that's what I've learned, you have to have a certain say if you take all these risks, because I took a lot of risk also personally. You know, I don't want to mention too many, but it is a huge pressure you're on, and your face is on all the newspapers and everything. And if you don't have the final say, I think it's a bit of a stretch. So that is something I've learned in a new company I set up. You've set it up based on steward ownership. And that is very interesting for social enterprises, because steward ownership basically is that you prevent a very important element, which you mentioned also in terms of the quarterly, is that venture capital is hugely flawed, in my opinion, on one very important element when it comes to social impact companies. And that is that venture capital is basically based on speculation. You buy shares at a certain price and you want to sell them at a higher price. That's the business model of venture capital. You go in early in a company and you look at the team, you hope it will, and with all good reasons. But at a certain point, you need to sell those shares. For an impact-driven company, that means that those shares have voting rights. And in 4 or 5 years from now, when you are going to sell that share as a venture capital, you might be an impact-driven investor or whatever, but you are going to sell those shares and the voting rights, I have no idea who's going to be having that at that point. So that is one thing that I've learned. It puts a lot of pressure also on a company when early shareholders want to have an exit. And so you don't know who's going to take off. At Fairphone, we have really great investors, so it turned out really well every time. And we have long-term investors. But with my new company, we changed that also for the reason that we were just talking about. And is that steward ownership solves this, and the fact that shareholders, want to have a huge say in the company by issuing only shares without voting rights. And they are redeemable, so you can buy them back as a company. What happens then is that, the true voting rights of the decision making, also shareholder decisions, are with the stewards of the company. And the stewards of the company is basically the people that set up the company instead of the investors. So
the power stays in the hands of the founders.
Not the founders, because also if a founder leaves the company, they also lose their votes. Because they only have non-voting shares as well. So it's basically you put specific shares, a type of share, which you call steward shares, and you give them to people that can look at the company without any economic burden. Let's put it that way.
So it's like having a house with a certain amount of keys and only the people living in that house.
Exactly, And the great thing is that this is how Patagonia basically reversed. They now made Mother Nature shareholder of the company. It's basically the same, right? So a lot of these companies are popping up nowadays where the voting right of the company, the impact, why a company exists and how to stay true to that impact without losing the commercial elements in place. Because investors, I do believe investors need to be rewarded for the money they put in and the risk they take and everything. But I think one of the things is how do you have a healthy kind of relationship with them? There are solutions to that.
When you said don't wait too long to fundraise, what did you mean here?
Yeah, so we were in a situation where we were growing the company really fast, and we also had this cost me my health as well. We had to, at a certain point, we had another crowdfunding done for 10 million, and we were spending that money already for building phones for the customers that that bought that Fairphone 2. But also we were making more phones for businesses, B2B operators. And these people, they don't do pre-sales, right? So they basically, you make the phones, you put the money in yourself. And then once the phones are ready and you ship them, then a month or 2 months later, you get your money. So what we were doing is we were always spending the money from the crowdfunders also producing new phones for growth. And because we didn't have any money of ourselves, because we never raised money, our reserves were basically, the money from the crowdfunders. So we were at a position that we needed to sell even more of the non-existing phones to be able to have enough cash to produce the phones that we could promise to the people that ordered one. So at a certain point, we needed like a couple of million to actually close a growth gap in a couple of weeks, because I was just seeing that the shit was hitting the fan. and that yeah, that we would end up in this situation of with a gap of money. And I started sending emails to Richard Branson and whoever, trying to find money. In the end, we succeeded to raise 5 million within a couple of weeks. But I can tell you that was the most stressful situation ever in my life in terms of the pressure I was on and the panic attacks and everything that came with it. And it was not even needed. If we just had fundraised before that, yes, we would have had to sell shares. And our investors at that point thought it was quite risky to get venture capital on board. And my learning is also, and it's probably different from other people, but my learning is that we got venture capital too late. If you look at the amount of stress that it brought upon the company in order to grow. And yeah, what happens when you are short of cash too long is also that the only management that you're doing is short-term management, and even hiring people you do with guilt because you don't know how long you're able to run the company. I, as a founder, was only occupied with raising small kinds of cash to be able to close the gaps instead of raising a big bar to actually grow the company. So I think it's really important to know at a certain point. Yeah, how much to have this conversation also with your shareholders in time that you create enough, especially for hardware companies, that you create enough equity in the company in order to grow, because it will help you to do more mid to long term planning. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't be on a tight budget, because it's very important not to dilute too much, obviously, in the beginning. But I've experienced the opposite, that we were just too late.
You mentioned management. What's your advice to recruit, to build your management team as a founder or for Fairphone? What have you learned there?
Yeah, I think the most important lesson for me is to hire people that are more experienced than you and hire for growth, right? At a certain point, you're growing and even can outgrow you, because as a founder, and I think if you just look at the numbers, I think only one out of five tech founders is still CEO after 5 years. The other four are part of them are actually unwillingly pushed out by shareholders. That's not a risk. I took the decision myself at a certain point to stop as a CEO. I think it's really good to look at where is my limit in terms of what I can and how I can grow, and who would be my successor, or in what kind of setup am I able to contribute to the company in a valuable way as a founder. And that means that you will have a certain setup, but it also depends on what stage the company is in. And I think as a founder, it's really important. So if you talk about what kind of management team you need, I think you need a management team that at a certain point that can work without you being the key person risk anymore. And that is what you really need to focus on. What that means for your company, you can define yourself. If you are very strong at a certain area, then you don't necessarily have to hire people there, but at least it should be such a way that the company should operate without you, and also look at yourself and where's my ceiling? How you call that? Where's my ceiling?
Your experience, your history here with Fairphone is you started the company as a founder and then you were the CEO until a few years ago. And then now you are a board member. How did you know you reached your limits?
Oh, from a health perspective, it was very clear. My partner at the time, she brought me to the mental health clinic, the crisis center, because I was having panic attacks already for days and weeks, actually. I just couldn't do it anymore. That had several reasons, but one of them definitely was that I was doing work I've never done before, and 90% of the time I it was new. If you are
out of your comfort zone,
if you're out of your comfort zone for too much time in a row and for too long, you will notice physically what's that has happened. So listen to your body, really listen to what is because we're very good at telling ourselves I'm learning, it's great, it's learning. I've the amount of times I told myself like, oh, this is a great situation, I can learn from it, Whereas, you know, deep from inside, I was crying and I just wanted to run away from the whole situation. You know, I know dealing with really the organizational part, I like the view on it, but I'm super sensitive for, you know, what people think of me as a leader, how, you know, I think I'm one of those leaders that is really good in the early stage to motivate people, to inspire them, to get them along. But when, I'd like to keep everyone happy. Right. And you can't in a company that grows. And I've made mistakes there to keep people on for too long. That started to keep me awake at night. The financials and running the financials and organization and all the operational aspects, it's not necessarily something I really like doing. I was doing it. That was 90% of my time. But I was also missing the creative part, the innovative part. And, you know, those are my strengths. The branding, and the company was not in a stage and a phase where it needed that kind of view. So I had to change into a leader that wasn't necessarily my strength. So once you know that, and I found out very late because of the pressure and everything, but I think you would be helped to have, especially when you have co-founders, to have very honest conversations about these things, because you can help each other here. And I think just really being able to, to be vulnerable, I think that is the key to the whole thing, because, you know, it's a very lonely kind of job as well to be leading a company. And if you, especially if you have never done that, you can feel isolated. And that in my case, I felt very, very isolated from the rest of the team, because there were friends and people I loved working with, and all of a sudden you're their boss and you have all these dynamics. And I rather just didn't want to deal with the whole HR thing, because, you know, who needs that? People are there to work and we trust them, right? So that is, I think, that's important to recognize these kind of indications of, you know, who am I fooling?
Hey, just a 10-second break to tell you. I just released a free video presentation to explain the three key strategies I use to get 7,500 change makers to follow me on LinkedIn and to reach more than 1 million people this year with my posts. It's free. Just follow the link in the description to download it. Yeah, because it's something that I haven't experienced it as a founder, but as an employee or as a consultant working with different companies, I've also seen it. It's very hard for a founder to reach, for the whole team of a company usually, to be able to grow to the different stages, because every stage is usually the skill you need in order to be able to be super quick at the beginning is not the same. It completely different skills that you need when you need to scale from 100 to 500 people, and you start to need to have like processes and stuff there. And I, from the founders that I've interviewed, is something that I can definitely, you know, back for everyone listening here, that it's very, you need to be able to change, or you need to be able to change the team.
That's a great way of looking at it. Yeah.
And I've seen it, you know, like with a client of mine too, like changing the team sometimes is what needs to be. And if you read the book Good to Great, if you've read it, also explains it. And I think it doesn't have to be that way. In Good to Great, it gives like a lot of example of people coming in and changing. But I've also talked in some of these podcast episodes with some founders who've managed to, one of them saying, you know, having a chameleon team who can change and evolve at every steps. But it's very, very hard to build. And I think thank you for sharing that. Being vulnerable is probably, and being honest with yourself is very, very important.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thanks for sharing that as well. And yes, I said, you know, there are examples really of you know, CEOs, founder CEOs that do a really good job, you know, even after 20, 30 years. So, but it takes another attitude. And I read this really nice blog about it. I forget who wrote it, but they were comparing it with football. And it was really funny. I don't know if you've got kids.
I got two kids.
Yeah. They were, I heard something in the background. Did they play football sometime?
He's four. He's playing already a lot in the yard, but
no, all right. Well, I got my kids played football at a very young age as well, and they had their matches. And if you look at the football match from young kids, what they do is they in Dutch they call it kluitjes football. So they glue together and they run after the ball. So everywhere where the ball is, they run, and everybody wants to score. It doesn't matter in which goal, right? I'm a bit like that, right? I want to score. I want to run after the ball. I want to be where the action is. And then when you get older, you need to play in position. That was already a big step for me to be playing in position and being not being able to run around the whole field. And then you're the captain of the team. When you really grow, when your company grows further, and you compare it to football, the startup is clear. That's running after, it's where the fire is. And then once you're scaling, you have to be in position. But when you're growing and growing, you also have to be able to stand beside. On the sideline and really coach that team, and really that phase, that coaching phase, not being in the field anymore was unacceptable for me. I want to be in the field, and I know I want to be in that field and be where the action is, and at least have a score once in a while as well. So it's, I think it has to do with an ego element as well. There's all kinds of things in there, but I liked that analogy because it made it a bit lighter for me, and I recognized it, and I thought, yeah, okay, I'm not going to be that coach.
I keep it for the future. Yeah, and I mean, and not everybody has see it. Yeah, so it's like,
I think a lot of people love being a coach. Yeah.
Yeah, but a lot of sometimes great players. A lot of great players are not great coach.
No.
And a lot of great coaches were not great players, actually.
No.
So
exactly.
It's really like, once you get older.
Yeah, it's a different leadership. Being the captain of a team is a different leadership than being a coach of a team.
So what would be a book or some books that you would recommend people to read?
I think The Hard Thing About Hard Things is quite interesting. Probably mentioned before in the podcast, but I think when the stuff that we're talking about now, it's from Ben Horowitz, who talks about one of the VCs, the top VCs. He's a Silicon Valley hotshot. But it's very interesting how he speaks about it. I remember him even talking about in the book about that he's, I think the father of his wife is dying and he can't even be there because he's fundraising. Stuff like that, and everybody has these stories where you feel, at least I felt very alone, and the decisions I made were, I felt a lot of guilt also towards my family. At certain points, I felt guilt towards the team of choosing for my family if I wasn't with the team, and there's like this loneliness when you're a sensitive person, which I am, of being running the company. It was really nice to read a book and recognize that that everybody's struggling with that, I've always said it's a shame they don't have a Entrepreneurs Anonymous group, because I think it would help. Where people can just complain a bit about personnel and complain and about the hardships and stuff like that, and then feel lighter. But I think reading about some of the challenges that others facing and learning from it, and just it's almost therapeutical even reading these stories.
It's a very good one, and it's one of these that are a little bit like the one from Chris Voss, which is very well done in a way that it's always a personal story and then the learnings.
And what is the learning, exactly?
Like the Chris Voss books about negotiation, like Split the Difference, Never Split the Difference. What is one thing...
And sorry to interrupt, but if you ask me about what my, this is in the context, but maybe a book, I really... it's a more philosophical one, but it's Hannah Arendt, and it's The Human Condition. And it's extremely interesting to also understand the cultural mess that we are in right now, and how the political system is not able also to solve the big challenges that we're facing. And one of the things that she speaks about in the book, which is really interesting, is also the role of politics as being the context in which storytelling is used to combine the commons with the private You know, so it combines what's good for me, what's good for us. And I think, you know, just looking through that whole philosophical kind of approach of the split between like the civilian and the consumer, and how politics should also glue those worlds together. Hannah Arendt and her book was really eye-opening for me in terms of understanding how storytelling, how branding, how everything that we do with Fairphone as well can be a political kind of means to make people connect with what connects us through products. It might sound a bit more, you know, holistic and philosophical, but I truly believe that one of the biggest challenges that we have in currently to solve the big problems in the world is we need a cultural transition, and that cultural transition comes from a lot of new kind of narratives that we need in order to change. And to create a healthy relationship with our environment and the products we use. You know, if consumerism was a religion, we'd all be extremists right now. And extremism makes blind. So
you need to talk about. Have you heard about the? I think isn't it Dutch, the founder of the Week.
No,
it's a person who wrote Reinventing Organizations.
Which was pretty big. Yeah.
And he launched a new project called The Week. And as listened to it in a podcast where it's three different sessions to actually activate change with you and the people around you. So yeah. It's something you commit with people, you know, you can do it with people from your work or your families, if they're, especially for those who are into, you know, who feel like they want to act, but they don't know how, or their family might not understand them, and you commit to three sessions where you actually watch a movie, and every time there is a small kind of workshop to do together after with some questions. And he has done a pretty extensive research and tests that, and it goes through three different, like the U shape, you know, the theory of the U, where you need to start with the first movie is apparently, you know, talking about all the problems and people are really depressed about it. And then the second one is about showing a few, like, you know, showing you're not alone, showing a few solutions. And then the third one is about talking about how to take action. And apparently he has done, they tested a lot, and they tested doing, if you only do the solution, you know, if you skip the part about the you know, talking about the fear and all the problems, then people don't feel so involved and it doesn't work. So you need to go through the three steps. And that what you're just telling me is, I think, also linked with that, the whole, it shows me as well how much the storytelling is important in everything we do at the moment. In order to go and to change the society the way we want to change it, we need to be able to, you know, it's very important that we have people and organizations that actually work on these storytellings, show the way, show what's not working, but show us all the solution.
Yeah, exactly. No, I totally agree. And that is, I think that you can do that through your brand as well, right? And I'm not talking about greenwashing here. I'm talking about having an authentic kind of voice on what you learn, how what works, what doesn't work. I think Fairphone has been doing that from the start. Yeah, and that really, you know, and it also involves, you know, being very open and also allow yourself to be vulnerable towards critique and everything, because even critique can be seen as support on improving things. So really opening that conversation through showing and storytelling has been always important to us. And especially when you just go back to the DNA of a campaigning organization, of course, storytelling is important.
So do you have one specific ask for the audience who are listening to us? I mean, I will share, you know, the link to a Fairphone so that people can check and order their Fairphone if they want to. I'll put the link in the description. But do you have any specific ask to the people listening to this podcast?
Well, the ask is very simple, and that is that in the end, the most sustainable phone is the phone you already own, right? So it might sound a bit double, but on the one hand, yes, Fairphone 5 is on the website and you can go there and you can buy it. We'd love the support, but only buy it if you really need it. And if you really want to have it, then make sure that you have a good, that you buy it and you have a good purpose for your old phone for somebody else. Because it's, you know, in the end, we need to have less phones into the world instead of more. And at the moment, there's more phones than people in the world. So there's a huge electronic waste problem that we have to deal with.
Thank you very much, Bas, for your time today. It was a pleasure and a very insightful interview for me.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Hey, if today's episode was useful, share it with your entrepreneurs' friends so that we can all have a bigger impact on this planet. And give it a 5-star on Apple Podcasts. That will make my day. Thanks so much in advance. Have a nice day.